KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today, I'm very excited to have on as a guest Michelle Bowens. Michelle is a longstanding technologist focusing on peer-to-peer technology, and we're going to be discussing his views and his theories with regard to peer-to-peer, as well as his organization, the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, or what we would call P2P. Peer-to-peer technology, P2P technology, is a topic that we have discussed with several guests on the show, most recently with guests that have discussed the role of technology in creation, guests that we have coming up on the show, including Clay Shirky, author of Here Comes Everybody, Professor Larry Lessig, who has written extensively in this area, Brett Frischman, professor at Loyola Chicago, who has also written about commons-based and peer production-based methods and his discussions of commons theory generally. So peer-to-peer technology is a topic that we have discussed in various iterations on Hearsay Culture, but we haven't spent an entire show discussing it, and I think this is a good time to do it, given the explosion in this kind of technology, but also the larger issue of what peer-to-peer means. And Michelle's work goes well beyond, in fact, it isn't confined at all to technology, but really to a broad-based theory of peer-to-peer, a theory of how we create and why we create and what that says culturally. And it's very interesting stuff, and I'm looking forward to the interview today. By way of background, Michelle has played a major role in the digital revolution in his home country of Belgium, where he's known as an internet pioneer. He created two dot-com companies, was the e-business strategic director for the telecommunications company Belgicom, and European manager of thought leadership for the U.S. web consultancy March 1st. He's also produced the three-hour TV documentary called Technocalypse, The Metaphysics of Technology and the End of Man, which I have to confess I haven't seen, but sounds fascinating, and co-edited two French-language books on the anthology of digital society, was editor-in-chief of the Flemish digital magazine Wave. He now lives in Thailand, where he created the Foundation for Peer-to-Peer Alternatives, and he's taught the anthropology of digital society for postgraduate students at ICHEC St. Louis in Brussels, Belgium, and related courses at Phayaphi University and Chiang Mai University in Thailand. So he brings a wealth of experience and background to this discussion, and I thought before we begin the discussion, I'd mention a couple of works that he's written, both of which can be found on the internet. One work entitled Peer-to-Peer and Human Evolution, Peer-to-Peer as the Premise of a New Mode of Civilization, gives you an idea of what we're going to be talking about today. And in that piece, Michelle discusses what he believes to be the main message of this emergent movement. And we're going to get into more detail of it, but I thought I'd quote a few sentences from it to contextualize our discussion before we begin. According to his article, he says, "It is us knowledge workers who are creating the value in the monetary system. The present system privately appropriates the results of a vast cooperative network of value creation, as we argued in our section," he references a previous area in the article. "Most value is not created in the formal procedures of the enterprise, but despite it. Because despite impediments, we remain creative and cooperative against all odds." And to jump ahead to the end of the quote, before we begin our discussion, he says, "You cannot just use the information commons as an externality. You have to fund it. Establishing such a system culminating in saturation of a universal wage divorced from work is in fact the very condition of your survival as an economic system, and at the same time allows us to thrive as knowledge workers by creating use value, meaning in our lives, time for learning and renewal that will bring back your money-making enterprise." So it's a very interesting confluence of both the commercial values and the commercial issues which run throughout the operation of the internet, and a broader-based theory of what it means to have the commons. So with that introduction, Michelle, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hello, Dave.
And I want to also acknowledge that I really appreciate all of the patience dealing with the logistics and getting the show together. I'm very happy to have you on today. Let's start, Michelle. I mentioned your background in some detail, but perhaps you may want to amplify it with a focus on how you got into or how you got interested in peer-to-peer technology and theory.
Well, in 2000, more or less, I was working for this telco company in Belgium called Belgacom, and I was heading an internal think tank called the Digital Futures Initiative. And you know, if you remember, 2001 was the year of the bubble. And as I was observing what was happening with internet companies and internet innovation, a very strange observation imposed itself, and it was the following: when the businesses collapsed, the innovation not only continued but intensified. And this is something, you know, that is very hard to explain. How can we explain that the whole Web 2.0 thing came about in an environment where there was no capital? So, you know, this led me to conclude that it's now possible to be creative and innovative without access necessarily to capital. And this is because our brains and the computers have become some kind of, you know, generalized social means of production that everybody can use, and intellectual innovation, you know, which is everything that it precedes actually the physical production of a thing, you know, is basically brain-based cooperation. And you don't need capital for that, necessarily. You know, Bram Cohen could develop BitTorrent using you know, fake credit cards, or not, maybe not fake credit cards, but he didn't have much money. And it's only when he became successful and when the servers, you know, threatened to explode that you need capital. But I think this is an interesting observation, is that people can aggregate together to create common value, and they can do this today without necessarily being, you know, a state or a government or a public authority or a company. They can do it, you know, through informal organization, you know, I call it self-aggregation.
Mm-hmm. And your focus on peer-to-peer is a long-standing one, and perhaps you could let me ask you another way. Was there a particular moment or an event? You mentioned the dot-com bubble, but anything in particular about it that really caused you to decide this is something I wanted to focus on largely exclusively?
Well, I think like most people, you know, it's Linux and Wikipedia, which kind of, you know, were the proof of concept that this thing could work. That, you know, it's just basically seeing today that what the internet enables is the global coordination of small groups. And, you know, this is a fundamental change, because if you think about, you know, the history of mankind, first we had small groups, you know, small tribes, families, clans, and everybody knew each other, and, you know, you could work with consensus. But as soon as we started growing, and, you know, some anthropologists think the limit is about 150 people, we needed hierarchy and organization. You know, the whole history is basically a history of, you know, centralization and hierarchy, replacing these original life forms that we had. And what we have now is, in my point of view, and this is what peer-to-peer is about, you know, peer-to-peer is the ability for individuals to freely engage in actions and relationships without asking permission and in pursuit of common value, right? And this is something we can do today, so we can have people worldwide working on a particular task, but it's coordinated, you know, within these huge projects like Wikipedia and Linux. And then we have to also see that actually today you have on the one side a proprietary company, you know, a private company using proprietary software, when it's competing with an open source community that works together with companies, it's the open source project that will actually end up winning the competition. The asymmetric competition is increasingly being won, you know, through the peer-to-peer dynamic. And I think that's a very significant observation.
Now, and we're going to talk about the impact of peer-to-peer shortly, but to allow listeners who may not be familiar with you or your organization some more background, what is the Peer-to-Peer Foundation and what are its goals?
Well, you know, basically we are some kind of, you know, I would call it a cyber collective. It's a group of people that, you know, join together from all over the world and decide to build a knowledge base around peer-to-peer and to be an internetworking platform of all kinds of initiatives in that area. So we're not a formal organization with members, you know, we're really a collective in a way. Though we do have, you know, kind of like an NGO structure based in the Netherlands, but that's just kind of like a formal thing, you know, so that we can do some fundraising. So basically we study three things. Peer production, which is the capability to create common value together. Peer governance, which is the ability to manage these processes. And peer property, which is how we can defend this common value creation from private appropriation. You know, if you and I work together voluntarily, then you don't want somebody to say, this is mine only. So, you know, you need some kind of protection mechanisms. And these three aspects, peer production, governance, and property, more or less correspond to three new paradigms that are emerging in our society. One is the open and free paradigm, which is basically saying that if we want to work together, we need raw material. This raw material has to be accessible, has to be modifiable, and this is why we have open content, open textbooks, you know, free software, open source software, open access publishing. It means that, you know, we need non-copyrighted material in order to be able to work together. The second paradigm, which is more or less the governance paradigm, is participation. Can we organize ourselves so that it's based on inclusion and not exclusion? So the P2P projects are designed to lower the threshold of participation. And the control mechanism, which used to be, you know, before. So in other words, let's assume you work for a magazine. Well, first of all, I need to be hired. Then I need an order from the editor-in-chief or I need his permission. And then my article will be judged. Now, in P2P, we do it differently. We give everybody the freedom to write. And then we have a process afterwards that controls the quality of what we've produced together. And then the third paradigm, it's the commons paradigm, is that when you produce something together on that basis, it has to be universally available. So you use licenses like the Creative Commons licenses or the general public license, which is used in free software, which basically say you can use it, but if you use it, anything you change will also be available to the community. And basically that's how, you know, how peer-to-peer grows. Open and free raw material, participatory processes, and commons-oriented output, which in turn creates new open and free material. So I hope that makes sense. You know, you can see that as a kind of circulation of the common, just as we have in the economy, we have a circulation of capital and money. And so this social system is not just one-off. It actually reproduces itself and continues to exist in the future and strengthen itself.
There are a lot of moving parts, obviously, and I do want to focus on one up front, which you often hear as a criticism of peer-to-peer creation, but something that you mentioned, which ultimately is quality control. You mentioned Wikipedia as an example, and of course one of the major criticisms of Wikipedia, but more generally of peer-based production, is quality. That the information is less accurate, or it's just not as good, et cetera, and so forth. But you discuss quality control as a core element of peer-to-peer production. So perhaps you could amplify or respond to that criticism that peer-to-peer created items are inherently of less quality than those that are not, that have gone through traditional production methods.
Okay, I would make a general statement about that, which is that, you know, generally speaking, if you have a open process competing with a closed process, I would tend to think that, you know, despite its problems, the open process will tend to win out. For example, you know, Wikipedia has basically replaced Britannica. I mean, Britannica is just no longer a factor in encyclopedia publishing. But this doesn't mean that Wikipedia doesn't have problems. And I actually believe myself it has serious problems and that it doesn't have a good process of quality control. But you can compare it to free software. You know, Linux is used to go to the moon. So there's just no doubt about it that Linux has to be, you know, a very strong, you know, trustworthy piece of software because, you know, lives depend on it. And I think that most software programmers today will argue to you that, you know, Linux and open source software is actually better than its proprietary alternative. Wikipedia is different. I think Wikipedia has made a number of mistakes. One is that, you know, it's something called, I forgot the term now, but basically, it has a rule that material in the Wikipedia has to be relevant, right? And this gives enormous powers to the editors. And I think that's a mistake. So what happens in Wikipedia is you have passionate writers of articles that usually know this stuff. And then you have editors that know less about the subject, but that know all the processes and rules of the Wikipedia. And they will kill your article if they deem it to be non-significant. So what happens in Wikipedia is since they instituted those rules about, you know, 18 months ago, the Wikipedia stopped growing. It's flat. The English Wikipedia is totally flat now. And I think it's because there is no true quality control, but it's a political process. It's, as an individual author, you can't win from the editors unless you mobilize politically. And so there's no place in Wikipedia for expertise, and this is, I think, something problematic.
Your critique of Wikipedia, it would seem, would suggest that there does need to be some kind of top-level control over what information is put into, or the inputs, I should say, of peer-to-peer production. But it doesn't seem like you go that far. So how, I guess I'll ask you, how does quality control work?
I can explain my own view on that.
Yep.
Now, I will tell you, for example, what is very crucial in peer production is that people have to have the freedom to produce, right? So you cannot institute a system which is top-down in the sense of I'll tell you what to do or I'll allow you to do something or not. Because once you institute those kinds of rules, you basically kill the volunteering. So it's not going to work. So if you look at free software, you know, anybody can produce code. But you have what's called maintainers or committers, and these are people who are individually responsible for the code in their domain, right? And they will or will not accept your code. And this is accepted within the software community as, you know, the way to do it. And now in Wikipedia, it's kind of a difficult issue because if you would put experts, you know, as the kind of top-down mechanism, then all the amateurs would stop collaborating. So here is my proposal. I propose to create an expert page in which certain people would have access, you know, let's say people with PhDs, and they could make comments on the main page. So in other words, the experts would have a role, which is a role of advice and evaluation, that would be a mirror, you know, to the page that exists. And then people, who actually write the article, could you be inspired by the expert-based commentary? I don't know if that makes sense to you, but this is kind of a way, because, you know, you have to marry expertise and passionate enthusiasm in a mutually inclusive way. Peer production is basically changing the role of experts from controllers to servants. You know, you are it's a form of servant leadership, if you like.
Mm-hmm. It does make sense to me, and I think it maybe in discussing these kinds of issues, it would be helpful to step back a little bit and perhaps a little more abstract, but certainly more theoretical. In your writings, you talk about peer-to-peer as not just a movement based upon technology, but a broader social concept of how we create. So perhaps we could talk about that with my basic question being, we're not just talking about technology. Is that correct?
That is totally correct. I think the role of technology is the following. Does it or not enable individuals to freely engage, you know, in relationships and actions? And that's a crucial thing. So if you look at the internet, it's not a pure peer-to-peer system anymore. There's all kinds of, you know, hierarchical and semi-hierarchical elements like the domain name system, you know, which doesn't make it a pure peer-to-peer system. The same thing for the web. The web is not a peer-to-peer system. It's a client-server system. But does it enable individuals to publish on their own or not? If it does that, and I believe that's what it does, then it enables, for me, peer-to-peer human relationships. And that's what's crucial. You know, the ability of humans to aggregate freely with each other to create common value. So it's enabled by technology, but it's not limited by technology. And you don't need pure peer-to-peer structures in technology to actually enable peer-to-peer sociality.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The next thing I want to say is it's also not limited to business or economics because, you know, you can create all kinds of value through self-aggregation. You can have peer-to-peer spirituality. You can have peer-to-peer politics. So peer-to-peer is much beyond, you know, open business models or crowdsourcing or, you know, all these new terms that we use to, you know, talk about the interplay between communities and corporations. It's way beyond, you know, just a business and a technological process.
The Peer-to-Peer Foundation, as you mentioned, has a broad-based goal, it seems, of really just allowing people to think more about these ideas. And you talk about anti-credentialism and equipotentiality in your writings. What do those terms mean?
All right. So, to explain it, I might have to go back to the, you know, the old way of doing things, which is basically, if you want to participate in a modern society, you have to have credentials. Yeah? If you don't have a PhD, you don't publish in an academic journal. If you don't have a diploma in journalism, you don't work, for my newspaper. And so this is called credentialism, and this is what kind of disappears in peer production. And what is replaced with is instead of judging you as a whole, I start judging humans as being a mix of skills and endeavors. And in some you're better than me, and in some others I'm better than you. So let's devise a system whereby each can contribute what he's good at and what he's passionate about. And so instead of having a division of labor, you know, into roles and jobs, what you have is you have projects which you consider as modules. And each module consists of a number of tasks, and it's each individual who knows himself who is going to say, I can contribute to that particular task. And nobody's going to, you know, give you permission to do that. So that's what we call equipotentiality. Everybody has the same potential to contribute to the common project. And as I said before, the control mechanisms are put at the back of the system instead of in front of the system. Now, I would like to add something because you ask me and you say that the P2P Foundation has broader goals, and I'd just like to say something about that.
Sure.
You know, my conviction is basically the following, is that, you know, we do it all wrong. And let me tell you why. It's basically our system now says nature is infinite. You know, we can use it at our leisure. And it's not true. You know, we are destroying the biosphere. We have global warming. We have all kinds of issues around the biosphere because we have a false notion of abundance in the material world. Then if we move to the immaterial world, you know, the world of culture, we create artificial scarcity. We create property rights, intellectual property rights, which do not give people permission to share creative works. And so what I'm saying is that we need to reverse that. I'm saying we need a system, a civilization which recognizes the limits of nature. So, you know, recognize the scarcity that we, that's really there in the natural environment. But at the same time, accept the infinite nature of cultural cooperation. And, you know, the way that, that works is that you can see it in free software. You have open communities which, you know, collaboratively create software that's available for everybody. It's not scarce. It's there for everybody. And then you have companies which create added value around it and will sell, you know, this scarce added value on the marketplace, right? So you see this cooperation between those two sides. And I think that this model that is now working in the sphere of software and content is eventually going to migrate to the sphere of physical production. I think we will have, and actually it's starting now, we will have open design communities designing, you know, solar and energy, wind energy. All kinds of designs will be produced by communities, and then we'll have an economy using those open designs and making the physical products. And the key thing will be how will these two things cooperate. You know, we're not yet sure how that will work.
We're talking with Michelle Bowens, a founder of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation here on Hearsay Culture on KZSU. And for those of you who listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University. You also know that KZSU requires donations from listeners in order to continue its diverse programming, including Hearsay Culture. KZSU, incidentally, for those of you listening by podcast, is the home base of Hearsay Culture. It is where the show originally airs, and it will continue to originally air on KZSU for as long as KZSU is around and I'm doing the show. And I have no plans, incidentally, of ending the show anytime in the foreseeable future. So, if you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of how you make the donation, I do hope you consider making one. And regardless, I also hope that you continue to listen to KZSU. So we're back on Hearsay Culture after that brief interlude with Michelle Bowens. And Michelle, you were mentioning right before that very brief break the open source movement, and you mentioned it earlier in the interview. And I think it would be a good time to discuss that a little bit. In terms of the actual impact of the open source movement in terms of commerce and change in business models, you mentioned that it's starting and that you see these impacts. So I guess I'll ask you, heretofore, what has been the impact, and where do we see the first movements of this kind of peer production and more traditional business models?
Well, I would say right now it's, you know, content and software, right? So I think it was Chris Anderson of Wired who recently published a blog item where he tried to calculate, you know, the free economy, which was mainly, I think, content and open source software. And he came to, I think, to something about $200 billion worldwide. You know, as a kind of value. I have read figures of the Linux alone, you know, it's just one of the free software projects, is just about like a $36 billion economy for the moment. But it's very hard in general to estimate the value because, you know, I'll give you the example of Linux. Well, on the one hand, you know, it creates these streams of value of $36 billion. But it also serves an enormous amount of money because, you know, like companies like IBM will spend 90% less on software infrastructure using Linux than they would have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that it's counted in those $36 billion. But I think in the software field, you know, I've spoken to, I was in the Bay Area in March, and I've spoken at the computer conference. I was talking to some venture capitalists, and they were quite clear in saying that, you know, they're no longer invested in proprietary software. So for them, the game was already over.
Hmm.
They were basically saying that, you know, proprietary software still exists and will continue to exist in the future, but new companies are open source. You know, they're just the baseline is if you want to start with software, you create an open source software. And so I think, you know, in terms of software, the game is basically won in a sense. You know, it's a reality right now. It's not an idea or something for the future. I think the same is largely true for many forms of content. You know, look at Google or YouTube. These are major and dominant companies. They don't produce content. They don't sell content. They use the content that we have produced, that we have peer-produced, and they represent it to us. And in order to fund the platform and to make a profit, they use advertising. They sell our attention to the advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but basically, this is already a form of, you know, a new economy that's based on peer-production. Is, you know, people say, well, it's the same as TV. No, TV, we had private producers producing programs that were presented to us for free. What we have with Google and YouTube and Flickr is we are producing the content that they are representing to us. So that's a different step. And it's already an example of, you know, pre-production already existing in our society. And the next step is moving this to physical production. So I'm monitoring right now what I call open design communities. You have, you know, Lego is making 15 or 10% of its turnover by Lego Factory, which is people making their own designs. We have people making all kinds of electronic components, like the Chumbi or the Arduino, you know, in Bug Labs. You might not have heard of them, but they are emerging everywhere. And there's lots of work around appropriate technology and in the environmental movement. And these people are, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Appropedia.com or Appropedia.org or Instructables. All these movements are using open designs to actually make things. So I think this is a very important development, and this is the next frontier. You know, you have to think that, you know, everything that we take for granted, cheap energy, cheap raw materials, those things are going up. That kind of capital is, you know, is becoming more expensive, but the kind of productive capital, the computers, but also the machinery is becoming cheaper. So what I see happening is basically a trend towards using open designs combined with relocalized production. I don't think this is for tomorrow, but I think that, you know, in the next 10 to 15 years, we'll see, you know, very strong emergence of those kinds of economies and business practices.
Richard Stallman, when he's interviewed, often makes the point, in his view, of the difference between open source and free. That open source is not the same as free software. And I guess in a similar vein, I'll ask you, when you're talking about peer-to-peer production, you're not talking about something being free, correct?
No. It can be free, but it doesn't have to be. Because free, you know, that's, I'm sure Richard explained, free can mean two things, right? It's free beer and free price. So the most important thing, of course, is free beer in the sense of free speech. It's, you know, what you are designing, what you're developing is published in a form, in a license that makes it available to everybody. Now, the free price thing is a derivative of that, because if you have an abundant resource that can be downloaded from the internet, why would you pay for it? So, it's not necessary, but, you know, there's a kind of logical relationship with those two kinds of free. Now, when you move to physical production, of course, that changes, because you need cost recovery mechanisms when, you know, when you actually produce something physical. So you can have open designs which are free, but people will still have to pay for the physical product.
Mm-hmm. And I guess along those same lines, or to transition a little bit into a broader discussion, when we talk about peer-to-peer, there's been a lot of writing about peer-to-peer, certainly in the United States, as well as Europe, and parts of Asia. And I'm wondering if you see a difference in how peer-to-peer is viewed across those different regions, I guess I'm focusing initially on those parts of the world, India, where we see technology and technological production having greater impact. Is there a difference in how peer-to-peer is viewed across, you know, aside from the United States, let's say Europe? Is this process viewed differently? Are there skepticisms or praise of peer-to-peer that differs across these regions?
I think is that there are differences that, you know, have to do with the culture. For example, in the United States, you know, many people will frame peer production in terms of the market. You know, they will say it's a market. Even though there's no price and no wages, they will still call it a market, and they will frame it as a free enterprise thing, you know. And in Europe, it will be more framed in terms of equality, you know, and social democratic kind of background. But I think that, you know, apart from the different metaphysics that people might have, what matters in peer production is the common object. And the common object is, let's make this thing together. And therefore, people with very different ideological backgrounds are going to work together, you know, and find a common ground. Now, I think in Asia, you know, it's still relatively underdeveloped at present. And of course, you know, the business paradigm, you know, is very strong, because these countries are growing, you know, very fast. You know, they're in the phase that we had in the 50s and the 60s. But I think that, you know, that will change, and that eventually, the true potential of peer-to-peer, even though it started in the West, you know, will find its expression in those other countries, because there's so much more potential to move ahead. I give you an example of open source cars. You know, there are a few projects around that. Now, in Europe, we have, you know, well-paid labor. We have, you know, big auto companies. You can ask yourself, what is the incentive, you know, for an open source car? There's not that much incentive. But let's assume that you're, you know, a rich family in Malaysia, and you have some money to invest, and there's this group of people saying, well, we have this open source car. Well, I think it will make a lot of sense, you know, once they discover this potential, that, you know, it's these regions that will say, oh, we'll work together with you, you know, we'll build that car, and we'll support you in making the designs. You know, this is what happened with generic medicines. It's a very big industry now in India. You know, the medicines are sold, you know, 100 to 1,000 times the price of production, right? And so we already have a peer-to-peer model basically in India, where these companies are using, you know, medicines where the patents have, you know, they're no longer active, and they're making open source medicines, and they're making money making open source medicine.
The topic is peer-to-peer production. We're chatting with Michelle Bowens, the founder of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, here on Hearsay Culture on KZSU. Michelle, we have about 10 minutes left, and it would be appropriate for me, given that right now in the United States, The Democratic National Convention is ongoing. The show is being recorded on August 26th. And I think it's appropriate in light of the political activity here in the United States to ask you a question about the politics of peer-to-peer. And we kind of got into that a little bit in discussing the different perspectives of peer-to-peer throughout the globe. Is there a politics of peer-to-peer production?
Well, I think so. I just want to make a general remark. It's, you know, when a new movement grows, and you know, I'm talking about open and free, participatory, commons-oriented concepts and practices and movements. You know, we see them emerging worldwide. But the first thing you do is, you know, transgress. I mean, when you have something new, and I think this is what peer-to-peer file sharing is about. You have young people; they want to listen to music. You know, they just go around the limitations and do what they want to do. And, you know, they don't care about the legal aspect of it. And, of course, in a, you know, when in a country like Sweden where 80% of the population is doing it, then you have a real problem because, you know, you can't put your granny in jail. You know, a law which is, you know, no longer accepted by the majority of the population is really something that needs to change. The second step, and I think that's a step of, you know, maturation, is when you start creating your own reality. So I think a lot of these things like Creative Commons, free software, is people creating their own realities, their own institutions, their own legal forms. It's only when this is strong enough that you can actually engage in actual politics, you know, actually changing the existing institutions and defend yourself. And I think, quite frankly, you know, we're not there yet. So for me, peer-to-peer is still an emergent political practice. But on the other hand, I think that, you know, most of the problems that we have in our society, like sustainability, cannot be solved in a traditional top-down manner. So, you know, the era of participation is just a necessity. So I think that institutions, you know, will be opening up, will have to open up. There will be social demand for that. And one particular way in which peer-to-peer can help is by creating, you know, special kinds of software and platforms where this can happen. And I think you had Lawrence Lessig in your show, and I'm not sure what you talked about, but you know that he changed his focus of his life from focusing on Creative Commons.
Yeah, we had him on prior to that change.
For sharing to open politics, and it's really changing the very process of politics that, you know, so that politics can change. Because I don't know if you agree with me, you know, but there's a growing disconnect between the mainstream political world, which seems to turn on itself, and all these things happening, you know, on the web and on the internet, and all these new things emerging, and you just don't see a very good mechanism from translating one into the other. So I think that's a, you know, moment of crisis we have in our culture, in our politics. But I think it's temporary.
Mm-hmm. And we did have Professor Lessig on prior to his move towards Change Congress, and hopefully in the future we'll have someone on from his organization to talk about his new work. Along the lines of the politics, and in the remaining about 6 or 7 minutes that we have, is whether peer-to-peer processes, in your view, can change the operations of government. Governments are notoriously difficult to change in operations, and here I am, you know, thinking about democracies, although theoretically you could have peer-to-peer production in just about any form of government. But I'm curious to get your view, and I guess to given the time we have to focus on democracies, do you see an opportunity for peer-to-peer to influence how government operates?
I think so. I first want to say the following. You know, I talk about peer governance, and peer governance really is only applicable where people, you know, voluntarily aggregate resources under their own control. So if I have access to my brain and to the internet and computers, I can give freely my contribution to a project. And because you know, I work together with you and you don't own me, you don't pay me, therefore we have to kind of find consensus to do things. But this doesn't work in society as a whole, because society as a whole is about allocating resources, about allocating scarce resources. And when we are in scarcity, you need either a hierarchy or the market or a democracy. So I think democracy is not abolished by peer-to-peer. I want to make this very important point. But I think that what we need is a new approach to the state, and I call it a shift to partner state policies. And it's basically recognizing that, you know, social innovation is now primary, so innovation, you know, happens through the networks and people working together. And I'll give you an example. I went to a French city in Bretagne, and the city authorities there were giving computers, webcast, podcast material, you know, to the people in that locality, and they were doing, they have trails, and the people were producing an oral history of that trail. They were producing, taping the birds on that trail. They were making photographs of all the landmarks. So what I'm saying is, if you look at this model, what does it mean? It's not a private company producing, you know, that touristic value. It's not the government producing it, but it's the government enabling it, enabling and empowering it. And I think this is the future for government. It's how can the government and public authorities in general, you know, when they recognize that the value can be created through community, how can they support that kind of process? So I think this is the future of government, is, you know, these kind of notions around what I call partner state policies, the support of social innovation. So in other words, the state is no longer just an arbiter between the private and the public. You know, this is the old left-right debate, right? You either liberalize or privatize something, or you regulate or nationalize it. But now we have three choices. We can have private companies do it, we can regulate it, and we can enable and empower social production. I think this is something that will liberate politics, you know, from this kind of left-right industrial straitjacket that we had for 200 years. And now we have an opening to a more free choice in three different ways.
The guest is Michelle Bowens, the founder of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. Michelle, I think it's appropriate in the last couple of minutes here to ask you, you're talking about, in large measure, what you're talking about is a movement, and a reemergence, if you will, of independent thinking with respect to production, and you've identified on today's show a number of areas where we see that happening. So I ask you, on behalf of the person who may be listening who is not involved in anything related to peer-to-peer production, and ask you the question of how someone who isn't familiar with these areas, who isn't involved with it, can get more involved in, and or more specifically, learn more about this area. Because it's still, as you mentioned, a cutting edge and hardly saturated idea, but one that's growing. So for that person, what do you suggest?
Well, I'll have to make some promotion for that, because that's basically what we aim to do. So the P2Pfoundation.net, you know, it's a wiki of 8,000 pages. And basically what we do is documenting peer-to-peer practices. So we, you know, we don't do it all yourself. But we point you to what other people are doing. And we have a structure by subject. So if you click on peer-to-peer politics, you'll find political peer-to-peer initiatives. If you click on spirituality, you'll find relational, participatory, spiritual practices. If you click on business, you'll find information about open business models. If you click on our open design section, you'll find all these projects working on open designs, etc. So I think that, you know, that would be a good advice, is have a look at our wiki at p2pfoundation.net, and then we have a blog, and we have a community on Ning, and, you know, and this will hopefully point you to something more specialized that you can use for your own benefit and eventually participate in. So our aim is not to replace what people are doing, it's bringing people together. It's showing that there's something common to open access in academic publishing and free software. There's something common to free software and initiatives to open up information about U.S. Congress. Making those links between everything that's open, participatory, and commons-oriented in all domains of social life, and, you know, this is, of course, a very ambitious goal, but this is what, you know, what we want to do. You know, this is what drives us, and so we kind of want to be the grease, you know, that makes these internetwork relationships more fluid, and so that people can learn more rapidly from each other.
The website, again, just to be clear, is literally P, the number 2, P, and then the word foundation.net.
That's kind of like the central, you know, place. And from there you can find the wiki, the blog, the community, the mailing list, everything else.
Terrific. Michelle Bowens, the founder of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Obviously, peer-to-peer is not is a growing area, and so I invite you back on the show, and thank you for joining us today from Thailand on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you very much for having interviewed me. I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks for the good question.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. We've been chatting with Michelle Bowens, the founder of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, here on Hearsay Culture. And for those people that are interested in finding out more about Hearsay Culture as a show, as always, the website hearsayculture.com is a place where you can not only find all of the podcasts of the show, but as well as the upcoming schedule. And I'm very excited to have on the guests that I have scheduled already for the rest of this quarter and the rest of the fall quarter. And among them are professors Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas, Little Rock, who'll be on discussing copyright in the internet. Paul Ohm from University of Colorado Boulder, also discussing issues involving computers and the law. Professor Neil Letano from USC, who's written a fascinating book called Copyright's Paradox, as well as Professor Mark Bauerlein, who's written a book quite different than, and certainly in perspective, than most of the guests that I've had on the show. But he's written a book called The Dumbest Generation, taking a much dimmer view of technology and its impact than most of the guests, and certainly Michelle Bowens, no exception. Professor Wendy Seltzer, who along with Andrew Luman will be discussing the TOR project, a rather controversial and interesting effort that focuses on anonymity and privacy with regard to electronic communications, and is really a challenging area, and I'm looking forward to that discussion. Professors David Levine, no relation, we're everywhere, but David Levine and Michelle Boldrin from Washington University in St. Louis, who have written a book Against Intellectual Monopoly, which is a book taking a much dimmer view of patent law than any other guest I think we've had on, but really arguing that the patent system itself should be eliminated, in essence. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. Michael Gollan has written a book entitled Driving Innovation, focusing on how intellectual property laws can be used by businesses. As I mentioned, Clay Shirky, the author of Here Comes Everybody, will be on the show as well. Hal Abelson and Ken Ledeen and Harry Lewis, who have written Blown to Bits about reputation on the internet, will be on. David Rice, the author of Geekonomics, another guest coming up in the fall, and Morel Hildebrandt, who's written a book called co-edited a book called Profiling the European Citizen, focusing on profiling and privacy practices with regard to identity in the EU. So a lot of guests coming up, a lot more opportunities to talk to people. As always, I encourage you to send me your ideas and suggestions and thoughts for future guests or how the show's going at dave@hearsayculture.com. You can also listen to the show not only by way of Hearsay Culture by podcast, but of course by listening to KZSU, either if you're in the Bay Area at 90.1 FM or certainly listening streaming live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. The show airs at 5 o'clock Pacific on Wednesdays. You can also get the show through iTunes, through the Center for Internet Society's webpage. You'll find it as a podcast. And lastly, through the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, the homepage for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks again for listening to Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Please stay tuned to KZSU. Have a great day.